So the theme that I've been sort of working with for a little while now, mostly because of Brian suggesting that I talk about the two wings of enlightenment, which were compassion and wisdom. I talked about what are actually the six perfections, of which five are associated with compassion, and one is the perfection of wisdom. And the perfections associated with compassion are things like giving, vigor, patience, and I can't remember the other two, which is a bad sign, of course. And then last week I talked about that in really concrete terms, because if you talk about the perfections as such, it sounds really abstract and idealistic. Like perfection of concentration is one of them, which is one-pointed mind, that you can focus on something. And, you know, developing a one-pointed mind is an amazing achievement. So, like so many other things, it ends up sounding like these are impossible ideals, and how can they possibly matter to us? So that was why last week I talked about cooking, and talked about cooking, if you approach it with a certain kind of attitude and consciousness, as actually practicing the perfections, because you can develop an understanding through cooking. You can develop an understanding of your relationship with concrete realities, and understand, if you contemplate where does food come from, where does it go, your relationship with it, your relationship with cooking, you can really learn about interdependence. And really, if you think about the two wings of enlightenment, they really are two sides of one coin, which is wisdom is the mind that understands the nature of reality, and the actual nature of the reality that we observe is that everything is dependently connected to everything else. And all of the perfections associated with compassion are ways of cultivating the actions that are based upon the understanding that everything connects to everything else. Now, that may seem a little not apparent in some ways, but if you think about the perfection of generosity, if you think of yourself as connected with everything else, and that what happens to everything impacts you, then the deepest understanding of that is an attitude of generosity, in the sense that you understand and you act in a way that reinforces the understanding that you're connected with everything, and that when others are happy, for example, that makes you happy. That it's pretty hard to be happy around miserable people. And especially if you're the one that's making them miserable, it's going to be really hard to be happy around them. But it's much easier to be happy around happy people, and even easier yet to be happy around people who you're making happy, because then they really like having you around. And then you feel like someone who people like having around. And I think that we experience some of this when we meet some people and we just feel like, I'd like to be around that person, you know. And why is that? There's something about that person. Who knows what it is? We just like being around them. So that was that's sort of the recap to bring us to this particular point. So then, what does this have to do with meditation? And in particular, what does it have to do with the kind of meditation that we've been practicing, which is meditation with images, and in particular, meditating in such a way as you recognize your identity with that image. So you recognize that Tara is who you are in a certain way, that there is within you Tara Buddha nature, that there is within you Vajrasattva Buddha nature, that Buddha nature is like a faceted diamond, and each of these images represents one of those facets of your own Buddha nature, your own Buddha mind, and you're practicing with that facet to remind yourself that that's what you are. So how does that relate to these other things I've been talking about the perfections? So to explain that requires looping back to something that I said quite a long time ago, which is that we know from some of the earliest discourses that the Buddha taught that he was very analytic in the way he talked with his students, and he was very practical in the way in which he talked with his students. And a lot of the way in which he approached issues, he would get very metaphysical questions, like where did the universe come from, and things like that. You know, and he would mostly say, what difference does that make? Knowing the answer to that question isn't going to make you less miserable, you know, and what I'm here to do is to tell you how to be happy in your life. I'm not here to tell you where the universe came from. So he never actually said, I don't know where it came from, which is interesting, because that's been the subject of some debate. What he said was, I'm not going to talk with you about that, because what difference does it make? But I mostly interpret that myself as meaning, I'm not going to talk with you about that because if I told you any of this stuff, you wouldn't understand it anyway, so let's not waste our time. So, but he talked in a very pragmatic way then about how to become happy and how to stop being unhappy. And that's the main theme the Dalai Lama always begins all of his discourses with. You know, there's no reason to not be happy in life. You just need to figure out how to get there. And actually, that's what the Buddha was doing, too. Although, if you pick up a book on Buddhism, you might not know that because of the way in which most scholars talk about Buddhism and the way Buddhism tends to get taught to certain kinds of people, especially in the West. But that really is what the Buddha was saying. I'm here to tell you how to get away from suffering. So getting away from suffering either means you're going to feel nothing or you're going to feel happy, either of which would be an improvement. So... So in doing that, he said the thing to do is to start off by looking at who you are and what your experience is. I mean, that's the basic place. And in that basic place, he said you could discern, if you looked really closely, that all of your experience could be divided into five categories, which are called the skandhas, technically, for what that's worth. He said everything that you experience falls in one of those categories. For example, everything you experience... you experience through a body, for one thing. So materiality is something that's there for certain. And he said, and if you're experiencing something, it's a perception, which is different. You know, perceiving something and having a physical body are two different things. You can perceive the body, but perceiving is still different than body in its character. So he went on about these five things, and I'm not going to go into them very much, except for one category, which is a category called, in Sanskrit, samskara. And this word, samskara, has been translated in a lot of different ways. And I'm going to use a really simple translation, which is habit pattern. And if you think about it, habits are a kind of a unique category of experience. You can't put your finger on a habit. And in fact, you can't necessarily even see a habit in any way. You can't even know that you have a habit, except sometimes indirectly people tell you about it, or you, over a period of time, you watch your behavior or watch what goes on in your mind or watch what you tend to do, and you see that, oh, that's habitual. And habits are interesting because they can change. In fact, we see that they do change. They can become stronger or they can become weaker. And there are ways to reinforce habits, and there are ways to make habits weaker. And if you really look closely from the Buddhist point of view at where happiness and unhappiness comes from, what you see is unhappiness tends to come from certain kinds of habitual behaviors, and that those habitual behaviors are founded usually on misunderstandings or problematic history in some way. You know, for example, we have a cat that if I'm out on the back porch sweeping, cat will freak out and run away. And so we've pretty much concluded that because this is a stray cat that adopted us, I won't say that we adopted it, it adopted us. Well, I don't know, Kay may have adopted it. It was mutual adoption. The point is that this cat's behavior is driven by the previous experience, probably of being beaten with a broom. Mm-hmm. And every time the cat sees a broom, Well, we don't beat it with a broom, of course. But it doesn't make any difference. This cat's been with us for 4 years now, I think. And never once have we shown it anything but affection. But it sees a broom and psht, off it goes. So, you know, someplace in its life, this cat had an experience of some pain, obviously being hit by a broom, some pain, which is associated with the image of that object. And it totally drives its behavior now. Now, you know, a cat is not in a position to change that kind of habit. That's a habit. That's a reaction, which is a habit. It's a habitual reaction to a perception of a broom. Irrespective of the fact that no broom around this house has ever touched that cat, the cat still has the same reaction. That cat can't change its behavior vis-a-vis the broom. And it's not really conscious of having a habit in relationship to the broom. But I could become conscious of its habit in relationship to the broom, just as I can become conscious of my habits in relation to many kinds of things, like people in positions of authority. You know, I have certain habitual patterns in relationship to men in positions of authority that have to do with my family. I mean, that's not rocket science for me to figure out. If I haven't figured out, you know, by age 64, you know, that would be pretty amazing. But some people don't get that figured out. You know, why don't they get that figured out? Because they don't have a certain kind of self-reflectiveness of watching their behaviors in relationship to things that are going on around them. And over a period of time, seeing that with a certain kind of situation, there's a certain kind of action or a certain kind of emotional state that always occurs. So when I'm around men in positions of power, certain kinds of things tend to happen. And a lot of them aren't very good, you know, and so they've tripped me up over time. And some of them are good because they've done, you know, those habits have served me well. But they're a mixture, and so I can notice them sometimes. And sometimes what happens is I don't notice them until after the interchange between the person in power happens, and then I have to sort out, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I can get there. So how do I get there? Well, I said it's a matter of self-consciousness of seeing the habit and making a change. But the way I get there often is by meditating. And this brings us back to the whole thing of the samskara is in the perfection of wisdom. And the way in which it does is that when you practice the kind of meditation that we practice, what you're doing is you're actually invoking a state of mind that you don't always have on a day-by-day basis. When you sit down and meditate, yourself as Tara, or as Manjushri, or as Vajrasattva, you're evoking a condition of mind, a state of mind, which you have potentially all the time, but is mostly, most of the time, not activated. It's just not there. And that might seem a little bit unusual in some respects, but it's not. And I can't tell you that there's scientific evidence for your having a Tara character of mind. But there is scientific evidence for there being different levels of consciousness and states of mind, which are now very interesting because they've been doing, I don't know what, maybe they're CAT scans or something like this, where they they're seeing people's brains and they can see the electrical activity in the brain as a whole, actually in 3D now because of, you know, computer technologies. And they can see that when you look at something like an image of a lamp, because I'm looking at a lamp, that's how I have to pick it, there's a certain pattern of electrical activity in your brain. If you say the word lamp, there's a different pattern of electrical activity. If you read the word lamp, there's a different pattern of electrical activity. Because different parts of the brain are activated when you're seeing, reading, hearing, speaking, even the same concept or the same word. Very, very different patterns in the brain. Because there's different parts of the brain that are associated with hearing, seeing, speaking, whatnot. So we know, I mean, on that mundane level, that there are different ways in which brain activity can occur. Now, I'm not saying the Buddha consciousness or Tara consciousness is a specific pattern of brain activity. I'm just saying that, you know, there's probably something going on that's similar, although I'm not a materialist. And the last person I ran into who was demonstrating this was, of all things, a geologist from Wisconsin who'd gotten into how do people learn and had become a consultant on this subject. So he was very materialistic in his orientation. You know, as far as he was concerned, all learning is about reorganizing the way brain patterns are occurring, and in particular, the myelination of the synapses. He was convinced that that explained everything. I have some different attitudes toward that, of course, but it doesn't really make any difference. The point is that there are different patterns of brain activity that we stimulate by doing different kinds of things, and you can be sure that meditating yourself as Tara stimulates something that's really different than any of the things that I talked about. So the point is, though, you can, by meditating and meditating yourself in one of these more elevated states of awareness, you can see the habit patterns differently. Right? Whether you are currently reacting to something or reflecting on something that happened in the past. So I could, and I have been over the last few days, meditating on, I've been meditating, but what happens when I'm meditating is recollections of that previous experience of last week keep coming in. Now, mostly you would see that stuff as a distraction to meditation. It's like, okay, here I am in the provost's office, to be concrete. Wait a minute, no, I'm sitting here meditating. I'm not in the provost's office. You know, get out of here. You know, I'm not the provost. You know, just get out of here experience. And it won't be very long before I'm back in the provost's office again, you know. So, you know, in some ways, for example, in the Zen tradition, it'd be kind of like, all right, there it is. Eventually it'll go away and don't worry about it. But in the Tibetan tradition, which is the tradition we're teaching from, it's worth taking part of your mind and keeping it associated with I'm meditating myself Tara or whatever, and another part of your mind looking at that pattern, because then you're looking at that pattern differently from a different part of your mind. You're not looking at it from the reactive part of your mind. You're looking at it from a detached, independent, if you're good at meditating particularly, a detached, independent, perhaps more open perspective. And then you start seeing things about what that habit pattern is, which are problematic. Now, all of the perfections are associated with dealing with these habit patterns in some way. And now here's a really interesting challenge. You know, if you're the kind of person that is very tight, ungenerous, you know, practicing generosity, I mean, literally getting out and doing something, evokes all kinds of responses, which are complicated for somebody who is not naturally generous. And then to sit down and meditate, and with some part of your mind, to be noticing how those patterns work, is part of the way in which you free yourself from that habit pattern. Because if you're unconscious of a habit pattern, it's running you completely. When you become conscious of it, you know, you can begin to develop a different kind of relationship to that habit pattern, and you can actually change it or reinforce it if it's a positive habit pattern. And you can actually work with your mind to do either of those things. But the first thing is to notice it. Then there are ways, actually, there are meditations where you can actually deal directly in meditation with those habits. And for some people, that looks like it's sort of avoiding the problem. For example, you can meditate on generosity, in which you see yourself, and you can see yourself. So this is a very specific meditation. You can see yourself, and you can see on one side, you can see all the people that you know surrounding you. And on one side, you put all the people you like, and on the other side, you put all the people you dislike. There may be some complicated way in which they fill the space, but nevertheless, on one side, like, and on the other side, dislike. And in the middle, people that are you kind of neutral about, you know, that you don't care much about, like maybe a checker at Safeway that you meet twice a week, but you don't have any relationship with, in terms of emotionality, but you know that person in a certain way, so they're in front of you. You feel neutral about them. And then you imagine yourself giving something in imaginary form to all the people you like. No problem. It's like, I'm giving you all my wealth. I'm going to die tomorrow and you're in my will. I give you all my wealth. Or I'm going to say nice things to you. Or you imagine, whatever, you know, you imagine. There are all kinds of ways in which you can imagine giving to the people that you like. So then you try doing it with the people that you feel neutral about. That gets a little bit more complicated when you watch what happens internally as you're doing that. And then you start doing it to the people you dislike. And then it gets really interesting, you know, what's happening inside when you do that. You know, and then you can take it farther. And you can literally start giving things to people you like and see how you react. Giving things to people that you feel neutral about and see how you react. Giving things to people you dislike and see how you react. And then look at those memories in meditation. And then look at what happens in the way those people react to you in meditation. Right? So the point of what I'm trying to explain here is that there is a relationship between the practice of the six perfections and meditation practice, that they're not separate from each other, that they actually do integrate with each other in a very intentional way, and that this is a very, very ancient tradition, in fact, because if you look at the oldest layers of Buddhism, what you find, apparently, because we only know what's in the scriptural traditions, we don't know everything that happened in the oral traditions, what you find is mostly people meditating and learning about the nature of their mind and learning about their habits and observing those things, and that's it. It's kind of analytic and passive in that respect. But then there are later traditions of Buddhism that get much more active and say, well, now let's use our imagination in a very creative and positive way. And then those traditions get very full and rich in the way in which they have you use your imagination, and they develop these kinds of practices. And they're very, very powerful practices. And they have a very extraordinary impact. And one of the reasons they have such an extraordinary impact is because what's making us unhappy and screwing up our relationships with the people around us and the world that we live in are negative kinds of habit patterns that produce negative states of mind that produce all kinds of unhappiness. And the reason they're negative, in the most fundamental sense, is because, well, you could say it's because they're addictive, which means in their character they're negative because their addictive behaviors have certain unwholesome qualities to them. But the reason they're negative in the most fundamental sense is because in some way they're unreal, that they're based upon fictitious, false ways of being in the world and fictitious assumptions and erroneous notions of what's true. And because they're based on erroneous notions of what's true, they can't possibly have a good outcome because they're based on fiction. You can't live in the world, the Buddha says. You cannot live in the world effectively and happily if all your premises are wrong. How is that going to be possible, right? I mean, if you think, I mean, to use an obvious example that's so thick as to be perhaps ridiculous, if you think that human beings float and you walk off a cliff, you're going to have an unhappy outcome, because human beings don't float on water, but not in air, generally speaking. Maybe some do, but you'll probably hit the ground. This can be unpleasant. That's kind of a fictitious premise, an obvious fictitious premise, which leads to a negative outcome. But in fact, all of our existence is full of erroneous premises of one kind or another, which do not congrue with the nature of reality. Because they don't congrue with the nature of reality, they can't possibly have a happy outcome, because you're doing something that's unreal. If the premise is not associated with reality, you're doing something that's unreal. If it's unreal, the world's going to let you know it's unreal in no uncertain terms. Right? If you think that everyone in the world owes you whatever you want because you're such a wonderful person, you're going to find out relatively quickly that that's not what life is going to be for you. Even if you're one of the Kardashian sisters or whoever the hell they are, you know, it's like the world is not going to keep this up. It just isn't. It's just not the way things are. And you will find out that that's not the way things are. So the practice of the perfections, then, is a way to come to terms with this and changing these habits. But the practice of wisdom, in particular, not only allows you to see the habits, but to see the underlying assumptions which generate those negative habit patterns. Because practice of wisdom, in particular, and so that's where we're going the next time I'm doing a talk, the practice of wisdom, in particular, addresses those assumptions. It gets at the root of the misunderstandings we have about what's going on around us, of which there are a very limited number of fundamental misunderstandings which generate a whole network of ideas about what's real, and those ideas are not what's real, and those ideas we can find. Those ideas are not too hard to find, and they can show us the underlying assumptions. So again, we can see that in meditation. We can see the way our minds work, and we can begin to understand that the way our minds work are instances of specific assumptions and understanding about the nature of reality. And then we can start seeing underlying patterns that cut through all of those things. And the way we tend to see those underlying patterns that cut through all of those things are because we have to study first, because we can't get at those things directly, but we can learn about those things, which is the reason I'm sitting up here yakking. We can learn about those things, and then we can see those underlying assumptions which support that whole network of ideas, which in turn support and rationalize that whole range of behaviors or habits, some of which are useful and some of which are problematic. Right? So that's how this whole pattern fits together of the six perfections and practicing them, understanding them, the two gross categories of compassion, which are the activities in the world which are positive and wholesome. But anyway, understanding the five perfections associated with compassion and the perfection of wisdom, how that fits in the process of meditation, and how the meditation or wisdom meditations in particular reveal these underlying assumptions. And from the Buddhist point of view, the fastest route to getting free then of all these negative habits that are driving one into unhappy places is to go right to the core, right to the single fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of reality that we're all carrying around, see it for what it is, and cut it off at the root. And just as if you have this huge tree full of branches and leaves and everything else, you know, you can spend a lot of time cutting back all of the branches, but if you really want to remove the tree, the most effective thing to do is just cut it at the root, and then the tree is gone. This is, of course, presuming that in doing so, you don't have a tree that will regrow from its roots, but Buddhists have a way of dealing with that issue, too. But anyway, you just cut right at the root, and if you can do that, then everything else follows, and real freedom comes from that, which is the point of all of this practice, is achieving freedom, because in freedom is happiness and peace and satisfaction. That's what it's about.